amount of dedication that goes into winning a championship and to celebrate it at the end of the season. If you love the game like I do and you don't get emotional, then I would question how much you really wanted it.
Who will emote to him next? Glenn Klein, middays on your radio friend, WRJN.
From the Fox Sports Studios in Los Angeles, here's Deb Carson.
The Cubs victory parade getting set to start shortly. Folks pouring into the streets of Chicago as the team gets set to celebrate their first World Series championship in 108 years. Meanwhile, NFL last night, Thursday night football action kicked off NFL Week 9 from Tampa. Falcons ripped the Buccaneers 43-28. Matt Ryan threw for 344 yards and four touchdowns.
I thought Julio got us going, kind of sparked us on that first drive of the second half. Not sure how many catches he had on that drive and in the second half in general, but his play really kind of got us going.
Taking a cue from Matt Ryan, Julio Jones, 8 catches, 111 yards, and a touchdown. College football, 14th-ranked Oklahoma won at Iowa State, 34-24. 15th-ranked Colorado down to UCLA, 20-10. I'm Deb Carson.
We are Fox Sports.
And we are Magnum.media's WRJN. This is your friendly neighborhood radio talk show host, play-by-play man, and color analyst for life, all wrapped up into one nice, neat package. Glenn Klein for a thank God it's Friday morning. And he is Rich Cohn, the author of books on the Rolling Stones, the 1985 Chicago Bears, the Jewish Mob, Jerry Weintraub, and lifelong Chicago Cubs fan. He's been chronicling his journey for pieces in the New York Times and Sports Illustrated. Please welcome back to your radio friend, Mr. Rich Cohn. Good morning, Rich.
Hey, Glenn.
So when's the book on the Cubs coming out?
Hopefully in time for the next World Series parade.
Yeah, they're just getting going. You went to all the World Series game. Incredible post on social networking. I'm actually a little surprised that you're not in the Windy City for the big parade this morning.
I thought about it. You know, after that seventh game, when the game was tied up in the ninth inning, honestly, I feel like I lost 2 years off my life. I couldn't believe it. All of Cubs history was like an acid flashback in my head. I thought, oh, my God, I can't believe this is going to happen. My brother texted me. I just threw up. And honestly, I felt at the end of that like I'd just been wrung out like an old dish rag. I felt so drained that I just had to come home and pass out. And I figure the only experience I had like this, although it was completely different because it wasn't stressful at all, was the 85 Bears. And I missed that parade, too. I'm not big into parades, but I'm big into Game 7.
Well, we can watch it on the TV.
So that's yeah.
And we can see much more of it by watching it.
Well, because
it.
Really, this is like a thing where there's all the stuff around it, the celebrations, the locker room, the champagne, but this actual baseball was so awesome that it's really the game. I mean, it really felt like here's a case where what's happening on the field is ultimately so much better than what's happening off the field that that's where your focus goes.
There's no question that a huge portion of the credit for getting the Cubs here so soon is the Renaissance man himself, manager Joe Maddon. And this may actually spark a renaissance in baseball overall. There were 40 million people watching Game 7. Now, that is contrary, Rich, to the column that came out that you penned in Sports Illustrated yesterday. And I want to just give the beautiful humans a sense of your perspective on what should happen next with the national pastime. Every story needs an ending. Without a proper conclusion, the first act fades to meaninglessness. Endless accretion turns everything into goo. When I was a child, I told my mother I was scared to die. She said she understood my fear, but I did not share it. Death is necessary, she said. The ending is what gives life meaning. And what better ending can there possibly be, not just to the 2016 baseball season, but to the game itself, after this long, pitiless drought, than a Chicago Cubs World Series championship? With this in mind, in perhaps the boldest proposal since the introduction by Charlie Finley of the fluorescent yellow baseball, I move that the game itself be declared complete, that the leagues disband, that the parks be turned into museums or sold for scrap, that the uniforms be given to Goodwill, and that the sports cease being played. This famous pastime, which first gained widespread national popularity shortly after the Civil War, which carried us through two world wars and the Great Depression, is our American epic. It is War and Peace. It has now reached its proper conclusion. End it. How did you come up with that concept, brah?
Well, because I've been, you know, obviously I'm kidding, you know, but basically I'm kidding to make the serious point, which is, the way it I'm just like of a melancholy nature. I just am that way. And I've been thinking about being a Cubs fan my whole life. I went to my first game in 1975. Is associated with losing. You know, you're the lovable losers. I don't know about the lovable part, you know, but the idea that if you're a Cubs fan, something always happens and it never works out. And being a Cubs fan is like believing in lost causes. And there's been this incredible drought. You know, the Cubs had never won in Wrigley Field. I don't mean literally in the field, but as tenants of Wrigley Field, World Series. So the idea is that this is such a momentous thing and it's such a conclusion that everything that happens later will diminish it. And what can we do to keep this moment, man? We made it back to 1908, and the only thing to do is just end it. You know, this is it. It doesn't get any better. And basically, you look at baseball and all the stories that were told what baseball is about, and to me, the biggest baseball story is the Cubs. I mean, I'm a Cubs fan, so of course, but basically, this team that was really one of the first teams and one of the first great powerhouses and won, you know, five pennants or something in the 1890s and was the New York Yankees of its day and was the greatest team, that team became this snake-bit, cursed franchise that had to wander around in this sort of wilderness of mirrors for well over 100 years and then finally found its way back to the place that it started. And so I'm somebody who likes to crop photographs, tell the story by leaving out as well as leaving in, and it seemed to me the only way to properly get the importance of that would be to end the game, or if not actually end it, to just toy with that idea for a minute.
You know, I posted the link to the Sports Illustrated article on my Facebook, and you folks can go read the whole article that appeared online in Sports Illustrated yesterday. And a number of my Facebook friends said, no, we want them to keep winning. And right. I said, I think you missed the point.
Right.
This is such a unique moment, not only in sports history or baseball history, but in cultural history. It's so unique that the thought of this is it. Okay, so what's the next big story in baseball? That the San Diego Padres finally win the World Series? I mean, come on. This is it, you guys. This Dan Patrick, who is not a Cubs fan, he grew up in the Cincinnati area, but he's a well-known sports commentator. He said this is the last great sports story.
Yeah, well, that's the point. I was trying to make it dramatically, which is it's almost like the minute Chris Bryant throws the ball to Anthony Rizzo and you get that third out, you kind of instinctively look up for the giant comet that's coming to destroy the Earth, you know?
Well, we might have that on Tuesday, the election. But so what happens, of course, in this game, and most of the people listening right now saw the game, but Rajay Davis hits this two-run home run to tie it up in the bottom of the eighth for the Indians. The Cubs had been up the entire game. The momentum was completely on our side. And then Joe Maddon brings Haroldis Chapman in. And I hear, you were at the game, so you didn't hear it. But the play-by-play man for Fox, Joe Buck, chooses at that moment to remind everybody and the vast majority of the multiple millions of people that were watching that broadcast and listening to it did not know what Joe Buck said about Haroldis Chapman and that he had been accused of domestic violence and that he had been suspended. Did you know this?
Yeah, I mean, did I know that Joe Buck said it or did I know that about Chapman?
No, that Buck said this.
No, because I was sitting...
I thought you might have heard it after the fact. But in any case, I'm watching this, and because I do communications for a living, I thought, oh, no. I didn't think, oh, no, when Davis hit the home run. I thought this is going to suck the energy right out of Cubs Nation worldwide. And sure enough, everything fell apart at that point. But then to continue your biblical metaphor that you use so beautifully, then it started raining. And if you know anything about sports, and if you know anything about life, when things aren't going well, you call a timeout. You slow it down. And then we found out, Rich, that during the rain delay, Jason Hayward, of all the Cubs, the guy that had been struggling mightily, who had made millions of dollars as a free agent coming to the Cubs, a former Cardinal, called a team meeting. And that changed the momentum again. And then, unlike what we've experienced as Cubs fans our whole lives and as kids, this one ended in triumph. And what a turn of events.
Yeah, and also it's one of those things where, because I was thinking the same thing about Hayward, and, you know, Hayward isn't just struggling the postseason, he struggled all season. You know, he hasn't hit at all. And I always said, like, in my nightmare, it's always two on, two out, and Hayward is up. Because he always hits a pop-up, which means to me that he's swinging too late, and I don't know what happened. So, but, of course, you know, you look back on it, and even his contract, everything that contributed to the Cubs finally winning is part of it, and it's absolutely worth it. So Hayward had his function. I mean, he made a lot of good plays. He had big hits. He had one big triple, I think, in the NLCS. He made great defensive plays. But his function, his historical function, was at that key moment when it seemed like the walls were caving in and it started to rain. He's the one who steps forward and has the meeting and changes the mood and reminds everybody who they are and that they're the team who's going to win the World Series, and thereby earns his $180 million or whatever it was, and you know, proves his historical function. Everything that happened was necessary and was right, and it was right that the Cubs had this horrible switch at the end with the home run, not only because, you know, it made it a more exciting game, but because the game itself became like a replica of the series, and the series became a replica of the season, which to me became a replica of all of Cubs history. And you had to relive it all one more time before they finally got there. And it was just, you know, and it's just an unbelievable thing. And watching there, you know, I was in the press box, and they'd already taken my Cubs hat away from me because I had to be neutral.
Wait.
I'm not neutral. I'm a Cubs
fan. Wait. You went to the press box with the Cubs hat on?
Yeah. They said, you can't wear that in here. Well, I'm like, why? They're like, well, you have to be neutral. You're the press. I'm like, but I'm not the neutral press. I'm the Cubs fan press. And if you, I'll show you some of my stories, and you will see that I am not neutral. And then I kept, you know, jumping up and cheering and then trying to pretend I had sneezed because I was getting in. At the end, I'm like, the hell with it. What are they going to do, kick me out? It's over. You know, I'm going insane. And then my first reaction was, as soon as they won, like, I got to get down there among the fans. And I went charging down and had that experience of being a guy who hadn't had a single alcoholic beverage suddenly in a crowd of people that had like 2 6-packs, which is always a very intense experience.
Well, you probably had that experience a few times with the Rolling Stones, where you were sober. And
then... But usually they had something to bring them up, but also to mellow them out.
I see.
You know,
yeah,
a cocktail.
Yes, if you will. Yeah. Well, my son... My oldest son, Joe, works for a sporting apparel company, and they flew him from Tampa to Cleveland because they obviously had an overflow of business. And at the last second, he got a ticket for that. He was at that game. My ticket that I was supposed to go to Wrigley Field on Saturday fell through. But my oldest son, that we've spent so many times, wonderful, amazing moments at Wrigley Field, got to go to Progressive Field. And he talked about how it was like being at a Cubs home game. So many Indian fans sold their tickets, Rich, to Cubs. That's rule number one. You do not sell out your team.
Yeah, well, I was at game six. And there were, it seemed like it was like 20% Cubs fans at game six. And I was staying in a hotel, and there were a lot of Cubs fans. And a really wild thing happened, which is in Game 6, the Cubs fans were scattered all over the park, but there was one group of Cubs fans in the right field bleachers. I don't know what you even call bleachers. Like 20 or 30 people loudly cheering through the whole game and getting yelled at by Indians fans. When Rizzo hit his home run, it landed in the middle of that group of Cubs fans.
Yeah.
Which was like the ball knew where it wanted to go.
Yeah, it did.
Wanted to go home. And but in this Game 7, it seemed more like 50-50. So I was wondering because all these Cubs fans obviously just jumped in their cars and drove to Cleveland and spent a whole bunch of money on tickets, but where did they get the tickets? And so what you're saying is these people actually sold their tickets to Game 7, which is, you know, hard to believe because it's they have the same. They have a long dry spell too, not as long. And you would think that's crazy. But it almost felt like the Cubs fans were gaining power, you know, as the game went on, and it did become kind of almost a home game for the Cubs.
Well, in my humble opinion, by those Indians fans, that was a mistake on the lake.
Right. But it was crazy, by the way, because I've been to hundreds of baseball games. I've been to the Super Bowl. I've been to all these things. I imagine what a World Cup crowd is like, because it never stopped. You know, like the cheering was just waves and waves of cheering.
Well,
I was completely unprepared for the intensity of it and the emotion of it. I mean, there were many times in the game when I was like on the verge of tears.
Oh, yeah, I cried towards the end of the game in the 10th inning, in the extra innings. But you talk about the energy. The energy was obviously with the Cubs nation, with the fandom. And as I said earlier, when Joe Buck said that about Aroldis Chapman, I literally said, oh, no, not when the wild pitch happened, not when the home run happened. But I did not know that Jason Hayward was changing and turning the tide again during that rain delay. He is the melancholy Rich Cohn. He is the author of The Sun and the Moon and the Rolling Stones and The Monsters, the book about the 1985 Bears. I can't wait for the Cubs book. So the last play of the game, little dribbler, tough play for Chris Bryant, the soon-to-be MVP, third baseman of the Chicago Cubs. And with his ripped baseball pants, he makes the play with a ear-to-ear smile on his face.
Right.
And throws the ball to Rizzo. Rizzo immediately puts the game ball, the winning ball, into his back pocket, and the celebration is on. So has the melancholy been affected, do you think, forever for Rich Cohn, seeing those kind of examples?
Yeah, but I'm 48 years old, man. It's like already happened to me. Like, my kids will grow up healthier and better people. They will be different. They believe now. My stupid kids believe that the Chicago Cubs are a great baseball team and always have been and are the dominant force in baseball. They have a completely warped sense of the world. My sense of the world is completely different than their sense of the world. It's like I grew up before World War II and they grew up after World War II. So, yes, I mean, I do feel actually a burden lifted and I feel better about it. And, you know, Joe Maddon said, I think he said that there wasn't a curse, okay? But there was a curse. That wasn't actually a physical Billy Goat curse, but it was this long drought and all the bad decisions and all the bad things that had happened had built up this kind of mental weight and mental force that would cause the team, like the Bartman game, you know, you'd see it, would cause the team to quit. There would be times when things would go wrong and they'd fall apart. And the Bartman game is a good example because that after that play was made, you know, the shortstop sort of blew and Taylor made double play.
Right.
And you felt like that weight, and even in game seven, you saw that weight all over the place. So suddenly Baez made a whole bunch of throwing errors.
Yeah.
I mean, there were crazy mistakes
yes.
being made. Weird things happened. I mean, I've never seen two runs score on a wild pitch in my whole life. So, I mean, crazy stuff. And then that home run. And, you know, when they pulled the tarp out, I thought, I mean, let me lie down in the infield, and you just pull the tarp over me, you know? But basically, that because they're so young, and this has been the lesson again for me throughout the playoffs, because they're so young and they're so good and they're so resilient, my wife, Jessica, she had a great line. She said it's like the curse is like a fever, and the Cubs are like fighting off this fever. So they just kept coming back, and that is how you ultimately defeat the curse. So to me, Game 7 wasn't a thing where it proved there was no curse and never had been a curse. It proved there was a curse, and they overcame it. And the curse was this mental block around the fact that they couldn't win. And that's something, by the way, you always heard in Cleveland, which I thought was interesting, which is they said after the Cavaliers won the championship, which they also came back down 1-3, you know, the whole attitude in Cleveland changed, and they felt that they could win the World Series because this burden had been lifted from the city. And I think like something similar happened, which is, and the other great lesson about why the other Cubs teams didn't win and this one did, and there's a bunch of different theories, but it just shows you how good a team has to be. I mean, this team is so good at so many positions. It's so much better than pretty much every other Cubs team even the 84 team. And then they could bring Schwarber back in and have him DHing, you know, which made the lineup like a murderer's row. And to me, the only other team I felt like that recently was the Yankees in the 1994 was just so good all over the field that unless something bad happened, they were going to win.
Well, I can tell you this, that it just didn't happen during the playoffs. There of many slogans that you talk about a young team, they had a great leader too. They had the professor. They had Joe Maddon. And they had a slogan, the Cubs did, and they would say it together in unison in a very Camp Menominee spirited sort of way, "We don't quit."
Right, but that slogan, why do you have Joe Maddon? Theo Epstein, who really put this whole thing together, why did he go get Joe Maddon? In addition to, because he knew that Joe Maddon was great at dealing with people. I mean, the case of the Chicago Cubs was unique. I remember a bunch of years ago, I did a story about, I traveled around the Chicago Cubs for like 3 weeks trying to figure out why they couldn't win. This was in 2000. And when I was with them, they lost like 12 games in a row. And you want to talk about depressing. Go into a team's locker room after they've just lost their 11th straight game. This was the Sammy Sosa Cubs, and everyone's whispering. I asked Joe Girardi, because he was on the team then at the end of his career, why can't this team win? And his thing was that, look, when you go around Yankee Stadium, there's pictures everywhere of the team celebrating pennant victories. When you go around the clubhouse here, it's all individuals. It's Ernie Banks or it's Fergie Jenkins. And the team is hugely important, and that is what they built. They built the team, and they built this idea of bad things are going to happen, and they're not going to defeat us because we feel like we're star-crossed. We're just going to plow through them. And so it was a team built almost to defy a curse.
He's Rich Cohn. He wrote the book on the Rolling Stones, The Sun and the Moon and the Rolling Stones, books on the 1985 Chicago Bears monsters, on the Jewish mob, tough Jews, on Jerry Weintraub. What's the title of Jerry's book again?
When I Stop Talking, You'll Know I'm Dead.
Yeah, that could be my title of book. But I've got your title for your book on the Chicago Cubs.
What's that?
Put Me Underneath the Tarp.
Your radio friend is AM 1400 WRJN, Racine, Kenosha, Milwaukee, a Magnum.media station.
And on this, thank God it's Friday, WRJN's Hour of Power follows the world's news.
Special report, Bridgegate verdicts.